This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Here's a question that gets to the heart of how our legal system works. Can a passionate civil rights advocate, an ardent feminist, and high-profile criminal defense lawyer who made no secret of her liberal views become a fair and effective federal judge?
Our next guest says the answer is yes. She's Judge Nancy Gertner of the U.S. District Court for the District of Massachusetts. Before President Bill Clinton appointed her to the federal bench in 1994, Gertner had built a remarkable career as a legal advocate, defending clients in some of the most high-profile cases of the time.
For example, she defended an anti-war activist on trial for her role in a bank robbery and murder of a Boston police officer.
She took on abortion rights cases, defended a woman who'd been sexually molested by her psychiatrist, and another who was tried for the murder of her abusive husband. And she did this at a time when there were few women in a stubbornly male profession.
Now, Judge Nancy Gertner is preparing to step down from the federal bench, and she's written a memoir, In Defense of Women, Memoirs of an Unrepentant Advocate. And Judge Gertner is here with us now, and thanks so much for coming into Radio Boston.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. So let me start right off and just ask you why you wrote this book. In the preface, you write that being a judge is supposed to be the pinnacle of your career, but you worried that the identity of a judge threatened to obliterate all traces of your earlier identity.
Right. What happened was that after you become a judge, you get introduced as if your life began the day you were sworn in as a judge. And I cared very much about this past and what I had done. It was also the case that as part of the confirmation process, I was supposed to go through all my stories to see what would embarrass the president. So I went through all my stories. I decided that nothing should embarrass the president. But then again, the president was Bill Clinton, and so there was an open question as to whether he could be embarrassed. That was another issue.
You told me just before we came in, went on the air, that you thought you were going to get this book written a lot sooner.
Right. I was waiting to be confirmed for 9 months. And at that point, my practice went to hell in a handbasket because nobody knew what I was going to be. And I was gathering my stories, and then I got confirmed. And then it took 6 years to write the book, and I was essentially judge by day and then writing about this other person whom I no longer was by night. So it took a long time.
Well, there's so much to discuss in this book about the times that you worked as an advocate and a civil rights attorney. We're talking about the sort of the 1970s through the 80s. And I wanted to just start by having you do a reading, if I could.
Sure.
And we talked about this right before. And let me just set it up. This is a reading right at the beginning of the book. You and Sonia Sotomayor were asked to speak to women law students at Yale. And this was back in the late 90s before Sotomayor was appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. The question the law students wanted to know is how you become a judge. Sotomayor went first, and she said, graduate from a place like Yale with a stellar record, become a prosecutor, work in corporate law, demonstrate in word and deed that you can be neutral, and take great care not to be associated with controversial issues. Then it was your turn, and you said,
it was my turn. I paused. How does one become a judge? I paused again. Yes, you graduate this fine institution with a stellar record. But then, and I paused for effect, ever the trial lawyer, my voice getting louder, the cadence quicker, you represent the first lesbian, feminist, radical, anti-Vietnam War activist accused of killing a police officer you can find. That would be your first major case in prime time. You take every abortion case in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. You speak out on the major hot-button legal issues of the day in successive rallies on the Boston Common or on television or in the editorial pages of the newspapers. You represent defendants of all stripes, from those in political corruption cases to high-profile murder cases. And for the final coup de grace, you marry the legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union in Massachusetts. In short, after doing everything that in this political culture, in this epoch of strident judicial politics, should disqualify you for the position, you become a judge.
That's terrific. And the book moves on from there with some fascinating cases that you were involved in. And I got to say, it evokes a time that has passed as well. What's your point here, though, that there's more than one way to become a judge?
Well, everyone has to move to neutral. We select judges in our late 40s and early 50s. We select them precisely because they have lived. We select them because they know something about the world. Other countries select judges in their 20s. So everybody has to move to neutral. The issue is not where you started, but where you end up. And in my next book, I will talk about how this kind of career actually prepared me to care about the courtroom as a place where rights are asserted and where rights are protected, and a really unique place in the world.
I know there's certain things you can't talk about because you're still a judge, but I want to ask you this. How has your first career as an advocate and a civil rights attorney, how did it affect how you are a judge, how you judge?
Well, it's interesting. First, one of the things about having had a career like this is I knew my biases. I knew them. I didn't pretend to have been, you know, a potted plant for 20 years and then suddenly become a judge. I knew my biases. And that, first, it made me want to explain what I did, lest anyone think that my past was determining what I was doing. So I wrote more decisions, I think, than many other judges do, in which I would try to explain what I was doing and how it derived from the cases and the law and not from who I was. In addition, I knew what it was like to walk into a courtroom as a powerless advocate, as a woman. I knew what it was like to walk into court with people that representing people that other people reviled. And I understood then how valuable this territory of rights is. I also knew what it was like to appear before unfair judges. I write in the book about how during the Sachs case, the judge met with the prosecutor. This is the anti-war, the woman accused of killing a police officer. The judge met with the prosecutor every day.
But he didn't meet with you.
No.
Which is a stunning breach of protocol.
Right. But it's very hard sometimes for me to describe it. I cared desperately for the fairness of this space. And that's what I tried to do.
Well, what I want to do is talk about a couple of these cases, and specifically the Susan Sachs case. But first, I want to just encourage our listeners to give us a call. We're talking to Judge Nancy Gertner. Before she was appointed to the federal bench in Massachusetts, she was an advocate and criminal defense lawyer. What do you hear in her story? What does it tell you about our criminal justice system? And can a liberal advocate become a fair judge? If you have questions for Judge Gertner, give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. So let's talk about this first case that really put you on the map, and you referenced it just a moment ago in that reading. This was 1975. This was your first big case defending Susan Sachs. And just for our listeners who might not know, she was an anti-war activist who participated in a 1970 bank robbery in Alston. In that robbery, the tragic result, the shooting of police officer Walter Schroeder, who left 9 children behind, she was on the lam for 5 years. She was apprehended. You took the case. Why?
Well, you understand there wasn't a really major competition. She figured that she was going to be going to jail for the rest of her life. She thought she didn't have a prayer of winning, and it was very important to her that there be that she be represented by a woman. I mean, it was a principled issue. It's almost as if the outcome was less important to her than the process. You understand that in 1975, there were no other women, or very few other women, criminal defense lawyers. I don't know. I think the only reason that I couldn't turn her down were two reasons. One is I couldn't admit that I was scared out of my mind. One of the things about women, I think, of my generation is somehow we all believed that we were carrying the entire mantle of the movement on our backs. And so if I turned down a case like this, it would somehow redound to the detriment of everyone. In addition, I understood who she was. I was 29. She was 25. We had both been on the New Haven Common years before, involving an anti-war demonstration. I was a legal observer, and she was a participant. So while I disagreed with what she did, I understood how that had happened. The notion of she was facing life imprisonment. And as I say in the book, I was 29 years old. Life was everything that we had to look forward to. And I wanted to help. It didn't occur to me for a minute that she wasn't going to be punished in some way. The question was whether we could save her life.
And the central legal issue, and correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I understood, is the idea of felony murder. That is, she took part in this bank robbery. She didn't take part in the actual murder. That wasn't the intent. But they were trying to try her on a, do I have this right, on a statute that if you participated in a felony in which a murder occurred, she would be held liable for the murder.
It's actually a 200-year-old concept. You participate in the felony, you take the consequences that flow from that felony, even if you didn't intend the ultimate murder. And the way this happened was that, in fact, the bank robbery was over. They were in the switch car. The person who was guarding the exit didn't realize that the bank robbery was over and shot the police officer.
So the basis of your defense then was?
Well, we really didn't have a defense. that was part of the interesting part about this. This was the government put on its case. The evidence against Susan Sachs actually turned not to be very substantial, except for two letters. The two letters were in which one she wrote to her father and one she wrote to her rabbi, essentially confessing to the crime. And we let the Boston community believe that the defense was going to be she did all this for the anti-war movement. And we had the icons of the anti-war movement ready to testify. When the government rested its case, not putting in the two inculpatory letters, because they wanted to do this after we had had this defense, I rested my case, which was a moment of unbelievable fright. No one had heard of me. If this didn't work, everyone would have assumed it was because Susan took a totally green lawyer. And when we rested our case without these letters coming in, then we watched as the jury initially was 9-3 for acquittal, then 10-2 for acquittal, and then 11-1 for acquittal. So it was craft rather than a defense that did it. And since this was perhaps, I think, my third or fourth trial, it taught me a great many lessons about the criminal justice system.
So just to sort of conclude this story, so it ended in a mistrial. She wasn't retried, and you eventually settled, and she went to jail for...
For 8 years. She had another charge, so she had got really no additional time on the Massachusetts charge. But the broader issue about why I would do this is that, our system is based on an adversary system, and it can't be said enough times. That means that everyone, no matter what they've done, has to have as vigorous a defense as we know how, and a vigorous defense to match the vigor of the government. And that's what I was trying to do without resources, not a whole lot of experience, and nothing but sort of grit.
You were also up against a really difficult atmosphere for women at that time, to say the least. And you write a lot about this in the book. You were treated poorly by everyone. You mentioned the judge. You even say you felt shunned or ignored by the man operating the elevator in the courthouse. How difficult was it to push through into this legal world, which was largely dominated by males?
You know, it was very difficult, but I actually think that the seeds of the book were written at this time. I'd go home at night and I would write what I felt because I couldn't talk about it. I couldn't complain about it. I couldn't do anything about it. But I write also about it's like the catcher trash talking the batter. That's what walking into the Suffolk Superior Court felt like. Everyone said something. Every effort to make conversation turned into a version of who the hell are you and why are you representing this woman?
You write quite powerfully in the book. It was just like this feeling, this constant message, hey, lady, you don't fit in here.
Right. And it would be, and I suspect that young lawyers feel this today as well. You know, you go in to get the file in the clerk's office and they say, I'm sorry, that's not available. I mean, at every step of the way, minor things turned into major ones.
We're talking to Judge Nancy Gertner about her career before she was a judge, when she was a criminal defense lawyer. Give us a call. What do you hear in her story? What does it tell you about the criminal justice system? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And let's go to Phil, who's calling from Winthrop. Hi, Phil.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well. What's on your mind?
Okay, I just wanted to make some comments about Judge Gertner. Once upon a time, many years ago, we were young lawyers. And she briefly was working on some civil litigation that was on the other side. And then she moved on bigger and better.
Whoop, Phil, are you still there?
Yeah.
Phil, I think we're losing you. Just try one more time, but I think we're losing your connection if you're on a cell phone.
Okay. Can you hear me?
We can. So go right ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to say I followed Judge Gertner's career, and I think she has been one of the best jurists in the First Circuit or any other circuit that I'm aware of as far as the understanding, the appreciation of the human condition, and her respect and love of the law. I think she was a great appointment to the federal judiciary. I'm sorry to see her step down, but she epitomizes the quality that the law should have, and that's the law with a soul.
All right,
that's
Phil. Thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it. And Judge Gertner, you got a fan out there in Winthrop.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Let's take one more call. Melissa from Franklin is calling. Hi, Melissa. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was responding to your earlier question you posed, basically, could a liberal judge make a neutral or unbiased decision? And I would say absolutely, of course, if they're a well-trained advocate of the law and if they understand constitutional intent and history. And we have to keep in mind that once what was considered what the norm, whether it be slavery or voting laws or lynchings or a whole host of other legal precedent was considered normal, and now people who favor that are sometimes labeled liberal, and people who warrant certain approaches to business are often called conservative. The labels are largely irrelevant as long as we have well-educated, thoughtful persons on the bench interpreting historical intent and content of the Constitution.
All right, Melissa, thanks so much for the call. Judge Gertner, do you want to respond to that?
I think that Melissa makes a great point, which is that in order to be a good lawyer, you have to put your personal feelings aside, because the way you talk in court is calling on concepts that are larger than yourself. A judge is one step over, which is to say, I know what my biases are, I know what I cared about as a lawyer and as an individual, but I also knew what judging required, and I knew it well. And as I had mentioned before, that meant struggling with my biases. There have been sleepless nights, and we all should have them. Struggling mm-hmm. with my biases, struggling particularly when the law had changed over the years from the time I was a lawyer to the time I was a judge and had gone in a direction with which I disapproved. So the struggle was, gee, I think that this is the fair outcome, but I can't get there from here. But I wasn't going to pretend that I didn't believe that this was the fair outcome. And I would try to understand how the law had gone where it had gone. But I knew the difference between judging and advocacy.
I'm curious to hear you talk a little bit about these concerns that are expressed about so-called activist judges. And it seems like these are terms that are sort of bandied about. You'll hear conservative criticism of judges who are perceived as liberal, and the other way around, sort of liberal criticisms of judges who are perceived as too conservative. What's the issue here? I mean, is there a danger of judges being too activist? And if so, what is it? Or is this sort of a false debate? What's your view on this?
I think it's an incoherent debate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so first, and it very much feels like whose ox is being gored.
Yeah.
Part of the debate is a larger debate about, you know, original intent of the Constitution. And the genius of the Constitution is that it was written broadly, and its words don't interpret themselves. People have to interpret it. People have to figure out what it means. And oftentimes what happens is if you disagree with someone's interpretation, then you are labeled an activist. I've actually watched over the past 17 years as this has happened. I mean, when I issued the decision against the FBI, the Boston Globe had a headline that said, "Fair and Meticulous Jurist." And then I watched when someone else disagreed, and suddenly it looked very different. So there's an issue about interpretation of words, which we have to interpret. But beyond that, as I say in the piece I did for the Globe, the day-to-day judging is about things that are not the grand constitutional issues. They're about access to the courts and access to juries, and I cared so much about access to the courts.
Let's see if we can take another call. Joe is calling from Newton. Hi, Joe.
I have a fundamental question about the fairness of the judicial system. Often you hear the phrase, the best defense that money can buy. It seems to me that there are built-in biases in the form of who your representation is, the judge that happens to hear the case. And it seems that you can get very different outcomes depending on these. And my question, how fair the judicial system is, and is the Lady of Justice truly blind?
Thanks, Joe. It's a great question for Judge Nancy Gertner.
Well, first of all, you raised two points. One is the notion of justice being what the best that money can buy. There is no question that in an adversary system, the outcome depends on the resources of the parties. On the criminal side, I do everything I can and other judges do to level the playing field. We provide counsel for people who can't afford it. But there's no question that resources matter. And that's troubling, and we need to do the best we can to equalize the resources of everyone. As far as judges and outcomes depending upon which judge you get, you know, judging, there are moments when one has to make come up with an interpretation, and there are bound to be differences from one courtroom to the other. What we say, what I think is the case, is that you struggle with the existing law, and you can be appealed. And the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court can then say, well, you know, this judgment was wrong. It's not perfect, but then again, you would not want each of us to be identical because then we'd be less human. And part of the concept of judging, as I said, is bringing your humanity to bear. If there are differences, if someone has gone too far afield, those differences can be addressed on appeal. And that's the way it happens. I write in the Boston Globe piece, you know, that you don't want judges to be like that Watson computer on Jeopardy. Mm. You know, you plug in the information and you get a result.
So there's got to be some humanity in there.
Humanity and judging. And that's going to mean there'll be differences from one to the other, but there are things that we do to try to keep the differences to a minimum.
I want to ask you, Judge Gertner, as a lawyer, you pushed hard to preserve a woman's right to abortion in Massachusetts. You challenged a law signed by Governor Ed King that prohibited the use of state funds for abortions. That was overturned in a landmark ruling. So this leads to sort of a general question about all of these interests that you represent. When it comes to women's rights, whether it's abortion rights, sexual discrimination, progress on raising the glass ceiling, we've come a long way since you started to practice. But how fragile is that progress, and how worried are you that we might slip back?
I'm actually very worried about that. Let me talk about discrimination. The economy has contracted the legal law employment force. And I only know this anecdotally, but it appears that the people leaving first are women. And that says something about the fragility of the gains. In addition, I don't think that we've fully come to grips with the relationship between work and family. I love to talk about the there's always an article at least once a year from the New York Times which says, you know, why there are no more women at the top, because they don't choose to. Mm. And then you read the article and you see choice. Now, that's very interesting. They feel discriminated against in the firm. There's no support for family. So they're leaving law practice. That doesn't feel choice-like. And they're going to raise their children because that continues to be expected more of women than of men. That doesn't seem like free choice. So, yes, the old cultural barriers remain and the old impediments in employment remain, not as bad as when I was a young lawyer, but they're certainly there. And the measure is that in this economy, we're losing women first. Hmm. At a time when 50% of the law schools are women and have been so for many years.
So what would be the remedy, the sort of short-term and long-term remedy for that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. One remedy I tried to do as a judge, which was to talk about the issue. And Yale Law Women, for example, once issued a report on the most family-friendly law firms. And they sent it to me, and they were very proud of it. What did the most family-friendly law firms look like? They had 12 and 13% women partners. And I wrote an article called The Revolution of Declining Expectations. I mean, the notion that that was acceptable after 50% of the law school classes were women seemed crazy. So there's a certain amount of moral suasion. And then we have discrimination laws that we have to figure out how to enforce better than we have.
Well, it's a fascinating read, and your career is certainly a fascinating one. And thank you so much for coming in to talk about it, both the book and your career. We're very grateful. That's Nancy Gertner. She's a judge with the U.S. District Court for the District of Massachusetts. She's also author of In Defense of Women, Memoirs of an Unrepentant Advocate. We'll be back after a short break. If there's more to come, stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is Radio Boston.